Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's a section in the Boston Globe Ideas section called Uncommon Knowledge, Surprising Insights from the Social Sciences. It's the kind of place where you'll read things like the upside of trauma or the downside of diversity, studies on why people who wear seatbelts are happier and why Facebook users are less positive. Frankly, these are the sort of counterintuitive scientific findings that make radio producers and newspaper writers salivate, all of us here at Word of Mouth included. Recently, the reliability and methodology behind many such studies has come into question. In a big way. In a recent article for Pacific Standard magazine, author and journalist Jerry Adler details a growing crisis within the field of social psychology and efforts being made to address it. Jerry, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Yeah, you write about a practical joke that highlights the problem here. Tell us about what Joseph Simmons and his colleagues set out to prove and why their experiment is such a big deal.
Well, what they set out to prove was something impossible, something not just counterintuitive, not just unlikely, but absolutely, literally impossible. And what they settled on was that people who listened to a particular music, a particular song, and they chose the Beatles' When I'm 64, are actually younger than people who listen to something else.
And how did they prove this?
Well, the trick was to use all of the accepted standard methods of social science and psychology. I mean, it would be easy enough to just make up the data. And one of the things that I talk about in my article is that there's a fair amount of that going on. But they didn't want to do that. They used real data. They recruited a bunch of undergraduates. They played one of three different songs for them. And then the real trick is they used statistical manipulation of their results in order to achieve a level of what's called statistical significance. That is, they found what they were looking for and applied mathematical manipulation in order to get that result and came up with something that could have been published. Was published, but as a with an acknowledgement that it was a hoax.
Okay, so you said accepted forms of statistics. What are some of the acceptable ways that social scientists might, let's say, torture data into supporting a hypothesis?
It's very interesting. The standard for acceptance of a paper in a peer-reviewed psychological journal typically is set at what they call P less than 0.05, P being the probability that the results that you got were the result of chance, and 0.05 being essentially 5%. In other words, there is less than a 1 in 20 chance that the results you got were simply nature throwing you a curve.
Hmm.
And there's a whole set of techniques called p-hacking for getting your results into that magic zone. One of the simplest things you do is you start out with, say, 10 or 20 subjects in your experiment, and you look at the results that you get from them. And if they aren't what you want, well, then you add five more and you look again. And you keep doing this until you get the results you want, and then you stop.
Did you say that these are peer-reviewed studies? I mean, something can be peer-reviewed and still pass muster if it's manipulating data in this manner?
That's right. In the paper that Joseph Simmons and his colleagues published, they explained everything that they did. And of course, if you did that on your paper, it would not be published. People would say, this is, you know, you're faking it. But if they had left that out, and it is entirely acceptable to leave it out, then the paper could have been published in a peer-reviewed publication. There are lots and lots of ways that people can do this. One of the other things that you do is you correct for various factors among your subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Perfectly acceptable and perfectly justified in some cases. You know, maybe women show the effect and men don't, or vice versa. So
right.
you throw out the ones that don't. But you just do whatever you need to do to get your results over that threshold.
So I'm going to go back to this idea that if something doesn't look quite right in hindsight, you should be able to go back and re-examine raw data. But they can keep stuff out that looks bad. First question, does anybody go back and look at the raw data?
Well, until now, it's been unusual to do that. There is a movement within social science, and I want to emphasize that these things are being undertaken by psychologists and social scientists themselves who want to clean up their act, to require that raw data be made available online, if not necessarily within the paper itself, so that other people can look at it. There is a kind of self-correcting movement here.
Jerry Adler is with us. We're talking about structural problems in social psychology and other fields that have led to the publication of some very dubious findings in recent years. You write about some of those projects created to push back against this trend. One of them is called the Reproducibility Project. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how it got started?
Right. One of the questions that people have been asking and never really had an answer to was how much of what gets published in these journals and therefore enters the scientific canon can actually be reproduced. If you go and do the same experiment again, how likely are you to get the same results? And this actually began with a young psychologist named Joseph Nozick at University of Virginia, who did a fabulous experiment with one of his grad students. He looked at the question of whether political moderates, who are often said to see the shades of gray between the black and the white, are actually better at seeing shades of gray than political extremists who only see things in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And so he tested them and got perfect results, and he was completely enthusiastic. This is the kind of thing that goes right on The Daily Show or a TED Talk or a front page article in the Science Times. And then he made what in retrospect was a terrible mistake. He did the experiment again. And this time the results
disappeared.
Wait,
isn't that the whole scientific method? It has to be reproducible?
Yes, it is. But very few people bother to do this. You don't want to reproduce your own results for exactly the reason that Joe Nozick stumbled upon. You don't want to reproduce someone else's results because there's no percentage in it. You probably won't get a paper out of it. All you can do is make yourself an enemy. Even if you don't confirm the results, you may not get a paper out of it. Look, that's what scientists, that's what professors do. They publish papers. This is how they advance in their field. And so that's the desideratum. That's what they're trying for. So Nozick and some of his colleagues at the University of Virginia said, let's take a sample of papers that were published over the course of a year in three leading psychological journals and try and reproduce these experiments precisely. They recruited a bunch of quite a few experimental psychologists all over the country, and they contacted the original authors and said, tell me exactly what you did. And they have gone about trying to reproduce the results. And most of them do reproduce, which is heartening. Some of them don't. That doesn't mean that the original experimenters were corrupt or monkeying with the numbers or anything else. Remember, the standard is 19 out of 20.
Right.
You're supposed to achieve a 95% certainty that your results were not the result of chance. Well, that means 1 out of 20 very possibly are the result of chance, and so that's what people are looking for.
So Simmons and Nozick are among those suggesting that scientists do what differently to address some of these structural research problems?
Well, Nozick's project is under the rubric of the open science framework. And so open science means you publish or at least make available all of your methods, all of your results, that is the raw data before it is put into the publishable form as a paper. And certain other requirements, such as you establish ahead of time how many subjects you're going to be testing so that you can't do
You can't just swell the number, for example.
You can't just keep adding people until you get the right answer, yeah.
Now, how do you think those recommendations might change the culture inside the scientific and, let's say, for truth's sake, the media community? Would there be fewer headlines on The Daily Show or Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me or fewer superstars or TED Talkers?
Mm-hmm. Well, this isn't the first time in the history of science that this issue has come to the fore and that people have tried to address it in this way. You know, science is a highly competitive field, and people are ambitious, and you know, they want grants, they want books, they need promotions, and so there is a tremendous incentive to try and cut corners to get ahead. The one thing that maybe is different now is that it is a lot easier to make material available through the internet. The repository of raw data can be established in a way that in the print era it really couldn't. There was no, you know, that stuff would have to be kept in a file drawer somewhere. So it is possible that we're going to see a somewhat stricter adherence to the scientific protocols that will improve the standards. But from the point of view of journalism, I mean, I was a science journalist myself, still am, really.
Yeah, and I have to make that point here, too, that we here at Word of Mouth and the magazine in which your article appeared, Pacific Standard, mm-hmm. are quite prone to putting these counterintuitive, you know, wow findings, potentially ambiguous science front and center. So what should we be doing differently as journalists?
I don't know that there's much that we can do differently as journalists. Our standard, the standard I held myself to at Newsweek for 25 years, was if something is in a respectable peer-reviewed publication, it's fair game. Mm-hmm. None of us are equipped to look into the data and look through the tables and charts and say, wait a minute, this doesn't seem quite right to us. We can't do that. Our job is to make this stuff accessible. The guardians have to be the editors of peer-reviewed journals, and maybe they need to shape up a little bit. There are some efforts on that too.
Well, Jerry Adler, I'm going to go listen to When I'm 64 and see what it does for me.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Jerry Adler, author and journalist. You'll find a link to read his article, which was in Pacific Standard, called The Reformation. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. There is one public radio personality who is reliably skeptical of social science research, frequent Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist Paula Poundstone. Here she is, calling one such study into question.
Paula, a British psychologist, has determined that the best way for a man to attract a woman at a nightclub is to do what?
Show her money.
Actually, flash the cash.
Yes. Mm.
No. In order to do this correctly, one must wear a white polyester three-piece suit with a black shirt opened halfway to the navel.
Disco dancing?
Yes, but disco dancing specifically like whom?
Like John Travolta?
Exactly right. Dance like John Travolta. Women like nothing better than a man confident enough to strut his stuff Travolta style on the dance floor.
You know, I've really been suspect of some of the studies that you guys mentioned. Where did you get that study? Was it done by Mr. Cotter's class?
It must be true. We read about it on the internet.
Yeah. I
think it was funded by the John Travolta Sexual Attraction Foundation.
Yes. Okay, let me just say, there are so many factors that can't be controlled here.
That's Paula Poundstone and the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me crew poking a little fun at social science. Word of Mouth continues with a look into a curious tradition that's been lost over the years, funeral cookies, a treat called death, after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. seems that for every special occasion, there is a special dessert. Cake on birthdays and for weddings, an assortment of pies on Thanksgiving and Christmas, and cookies at a funeral. Meg Favreau is writer, comedian, and regular contributor to the online food magazine Table Matters. She explored the history and meaning behind funeral dessert traditions in an article called A Snack Called Death. Hello, Meg.
Hi, Virginia.
When and where did you discover the lost tradition of the funeral cookie?
Well, last year I went to this great event here in Los Angeles called the Death Salon. It's put on by this group called the Order of the Good Death, which is a small collection of generally young funeral professionals, scholars who are interested in death, and journalists who are interested in death. And so it was just a really fascinating group of people. And for the last evening party, there's this fantastic writer and cook, Sarah Elizabeth Troop, who runs a blog called Nourishing Death. And she created this amazing spread of funeral foods for the evening. And the thing that really caught my eye were there were these little 2-inch square paper packages that had wax seals on them. And when you open them up, inside was a small buttery spiced cookie. And that was a funeral biscuit.
What is the origin of this funeral biscuit?
Well, it has a really long history, but this particular one, the wrapped funeral biscuit, goes back to about Victorian England, where they would be given away as a memento at the end of funerals. And there's actually a great example of one that not only was a wrapped funeral biscuit, but it has the deceased's name on it and a poem to remember them by.
Wow. Well, how have funeral dessert traditions varied across cultures?
The types of foods vary widely. There's different types of cookies. In Wales, it's more of a lady finger. In colonial America, it was more of like a buttery biscuit, usually molasses-based. But it always has to do with basically breaking bread together and sharing memories of the deceased.
You write about another funeral food trend that died out some time ago. Now, this is called sin eating. What is that?
Oh, sin eating is fascinating. It's the process of passing food or drink over a corpse to a person who then eats it. And the person who eats it takes on the sins of the deceased so they can go on into heaven sin free. Sometimes it would be the relatives who did this at a funeral. But in some communities, there were actually poor people in the community who were paid a small amount to eat sins.
Wow.
And they were generally looked down on. Yeah. There's actually a community in Shropshire that claims to have the grave of the last sin eater who died in 1906.
That's quite a sacrifice to make.
Yeah.
I can see that you wouldn't have a lot of takers for that one. But why do you think these funeral dessert traditions fell out of fashion?
I don't think they necessarily fell out of fashion. I think that they've changed. You know, we might not take away cookies from funerals anymore, but we often have other little bits of memory to take away, whether it's a bracelet with the deceased's name, or even just a program where people have contributed memories that they have about the deceased. And we still share food after funerals. You know, when my grandmother died, one of the most powerful parts of the day of the funeral was going to my grandmother's house after and sharing in all of the food that everyone brought to celebrate my grandmother and remember her.
The kind of casseroles and left in the freezer, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Were you, Meg, able to find any of the original recipes from some of these more traditional funeral desserts, like the funeral biscuit, for example?
Well, the thing that's interesting about recipes like this is that because they were so common, they were things that everybody made, they weren't put in cookbooks. And so it's actually hard to find many of the original recipes for these. So the recipes that I have with my article are based on a lot of research. For example, the Welsh funeral cookies are ladyfinger-like. So I have a ladyfinger recipe from the time period. And the American colonial funeral cookies were buttery, molasses, and often seasoned with caraway seeds. And so I developed a recipe based off my research for that.
Hmm. So what would you do if you were going to update the funeral cookie for the 21st century? Of course, you're in Los Angeles. Would it be made out of spelt or something like that?
I think that the updated feed roll cookie is really just a classic cookie that you love. It's something that you can give to everyone and share and people find comforting. So, I mean, personally, I always think a nice piece of shortbread is comforting and good to share. And the recipe that I developed for the molasses cookie, it's molassesy, it's buttery. I mean, that's really, I hate to utter the phrase my ideal funeral cookie, because that sounds a little bizarre, but I think that's actually my ideal funeral cookie.
Meg Favreau, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Meg Favreau, a writer, comedian, and a regular contributor to the online food magazine Table Matters. You'll find a link to her article, A Snack Called Death, and find her recipe for funeral biscuits at wordofmouthradio.org. While the funeral cookie may have died out in the early 20th century, a new enduring snack emerged a few decades later, the Frito. When Word of Mouth continues, the surprisingly fascinating story of the man behind Fritos. That's after the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth. Word of
mouth. Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Next time you find yourself in the chip aisle at the grocery store, you'll notice Fritos among the dominant snacks with a wide array of offerings. Barbecued flavored, chili cheese flavored, Flamin' Hot flavored, honey flavored, etc. But like most great American success stories, the Frito had humble beginnings. For their Hidden Kitchen series, the Kitchen Sisters traveled to Texas to follow the secretive saga of a Texas corn chip and C.E. Doolin, the can-do kitchen visionary behind it.
He was consumed by Fritos. He worked incessantly at home, on vacation, on weekends. He loved it. He experimented in the kitchen at home. We were his guinea pigs. I'm Kalita Doolin. I grew up here in Dallas, and I'm the daughter of Charles Elmer Doolin, the founder of the Frito Company. He had a bakery in San Antonio, a confectionery. It was 1932. He wanted to have chips on the counter. Tortillas staled too easily. So he found a chip in a gas station that was an extruded chip. He bought the recipe, patent, and 14 customers from a man who was from Mexico who lived in San Antonio. It's a masa fried in a corn oil. Salted. Dad named it Fritos. It means fried thing. That's what they are in Mexico, is they're Fritos. The beach food, the little fried stuff. He began the manufacturing with his mother and brother in the kitchen. They were making them by hand, using a potato ricer with a slot instead of the little round holes, bagging them and selling them by day to gas stations.
He had lots of hidden kitchens. He had the kitchen off to the side of his office. He had the kitchen at home. He had factories, and on the counter he had a line of Bunsen burners with little tripods with metal trays on top of them. I'm Alan Governor, and I'm Kalita's husband. He was always experimenting, mixing up new flavors. He'd call the employees into his office and have them taste the different flavoring for the chips.
There were experimental farms where he was hybridizing his own corn and trying to discover ways to use the byproducts. Part of the secret ingredients of Frito is that it's his own corn. He and his brother invented a lot of the machinery, did all of the conveyor belts, like, you know, Ford automobiles, the mechanization of snack food.
Yeah, our ingredient cost had never exceeded 54%. We would have added 5 more months to the profit picture.
He worked constantly. He had a recording machine in his car.
When we add 13% for labor...
He was big and handsome, and my first impression was, oh my. Our wedding was scheduled for 8 o'clock in the morning. The reason I was given is that we have to be on the road by 10 on the way to California and open that plant.
Texas of that era was a hotbed of kind of populist thinking. It was a right-to-work state. It was a can-do kind of place. The East Texas oil fields were discovered in the midst of the Depression. There was hope that people could make something out of nothing. And I think that he was part of that spirit.
He also invented the Cheetos. He believed in having Fritos and Cheetos as a side dish with a sandwich or a soup. He wasn't consciously making a snack food. That was not his vision.
Munch a bunch of munch a bunch a munch a bunch a munch a bunch of Fritos go with lunch. Munch a bunch a munch a bunch a munch.
Well, I never brought Fritos. We didn't have them at home that much, and when we did, Dad brought them off the conveyor belt with no salt on them. Dad was into health food. He was the treasurer of the Natural Food Association. We always went to the meetings. He was a follower of Dr. Shelton in San Antonio, who had a clinic for fasting.
Before I undertake to tell you how to assure yourself at all times an abundance of energy, I'm going to tell you how you dissipate your energy. Because if you didn't dissipate it, you would have an abundance of energy. We do not need to know what nerve energy is. We need to know only the laws of its operation. Then we can deal with nerve energy as intelligently and as certainly as the electrical engineer deals with electricity.
Dad was vegetarian. He had a bad heart and bad lungs and weight problems, and he was looking for alternative cures. We were raised vegetarian, and people made fun of me for eating yogurt and figs in my sack lunch.
Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee.
He had an experimental restaurant in Disneyland when it was first built, in Frontierland, called Casa de Fritos. He had a little restaurant here in Dallas also that was a hybrid of hamburgers and Mexican food. He was on the verge of starting fast food. If he'd lived a little bit longer, McDonald's might be McFritos or something.
I actually didn't think Fritos was so very different from a Mexican tortilla. It's just a little bit different process. Very handy and tasty and a great step forward, in my opinion.
Mom would use Fritos in cooking, making up recipes. Fritoki pie was one of her inventions. Recipes were printed on the back of the bag. One of the most strange ones is called Jets. Melted dark chocolate with Fritos dropped onto a cookie sheet to solidify. Fat on top of fat.
And that story was produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, and mixed by Jim McKee. Food created in a lab is no longer the sole domain of the snack industry, or NASA. When Word of Mouth continues, a Silicon Valley-type startup that believes the key to sustainability can be found in the chickenless egg. We'll crack that story open after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Here's an energy-efficient alternative for those opposed to factory farming, the substitute egg made by a company called Hampton Creek. Or Beyond Meat's vegetable-based chicken substitute, proteins made from algae or fat cells, or Unreal Foods junk food with less junk. With billions of people to feed and shrinking land capacity to do it, a number of entrepreneurs are experimenting with Food 2.0, which freelance writer Ted Greenwald found may be the next startup craze. He wrote about it for MIT Technology Review. Ted Greenwald, great to have you with us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So you described the atmosphere at Hampton Foods, unlike typical Silicon Valley startups. Describe your visit there, if you would.
Sure. The offices are in San Francisco, which is unusual for a sort of Silicon Valley-style startup, although since Twitter moved into San Francisco, it's become more and more the norm. But you walk in, and at least in the front, it's a small space, and in the front it looks a lot like a typical tech startup. The marketing people are in the front. There's a couch. There's a dog lying on the couch. There's a picture of Bill Gates on the wall eating one of Hampton Creek's cookies. But what's really overwhelming about it is the noise. It's just incredibly loud in there. That's the sound of, you know, industrial strength blenders and grinders and heavy equipment that's doing the work of replacing the egg in our food supply.
Is this a new trend? There are other startups in this movement that you call Food 2.0.
There's been a rash of investments in food companies. A number of them have been in food service companies and apps that help you find restaurants and things like that. I haven't really paid attention to that side of it. I've been much more interested in people who are innovating in food itself. You mentioned in your intro Beyond Meat. That's a vegetable protein-based meat substitute using technology out of the University of Missouri. You can find their products in stores. They make vegan chicken strips that are really pretty convincing. But there's a lot of fringier stuff going on in this field. A company called Modern Meadow is growing meat in petri dishes, essentially. A company called Solazyme is making what really amount to dairy substitutes out of algae. And there's a company called Sandhill Foods that's really, it's very hard to tell what they're doing, but they are making meat substitutes, and they're using, I think, extraordinarily high-tech methods to figure out the psychology and the neurology of meat flavor and aroma and texture to essentially, I think, try to trick us into feeling like we're eating a satisfying piece of meat when we're really eating something else.
What kind of investments are behind these foods or Hampton Creek, for example?
Well, Hampton Creek has amassed a war chest of, $30 million in total. Recently completed a Series B round that was led by Asia's wealthiest person, Li Ka-shing. $23 million investment that included a number of Silicon Valley investors, including Jerry Yang, founder of Yahoo, Scott Bannister, who's been behind a lot of progressive investments, Horizon Ventures, and other VC firms.
How does Hampton Creek propose its substitute egg is better for us or for the planet than the chicken eggs now on sale in supermarkets?
So the main issue, I think that Hampton Creek's founder, Josh Tetrick, likes to highlight is animal cruelty. California passed a law, I believe last year, that set limits on how closely together chickens could be held in cages and other parameters of their treatment. Chicken farming is pretty nasty, and Hampton Creek would like to do away with it. I think on the grounds that they would feel better if it, you know, if they could make a dent in the animal cruelty around egg farming. However, they can also eliminate cholesterol. They can reduce fat. And they say they can make an egg that's, currently their product is half the price of a conventional egg. And they hope to get it down to much, much lower than that, maybe a tenth.
How does it differ from egg beaters or other, you know, egg substitutes that are on the market?
Yeah, well, egg beaters, that particular brand of egg substitute isn't really an egg substitute. It's actually egg whites. And the selling point of egg beaters is that since there's no yolk, you don't get any cholesterol. And for people who are concerned about cholesterol in their diet, that seems like a good way to go. Then there are lots of other egg substitute products that are generally made from vegetable protein. You can go buy a bag of Bob's Red Mill vegan egg mix, and it's a mix of grains and other stuff.
Could you use that in baking, for example? You know, because eggs do more than just provide protein. They're, what, emulsifiers? They leaven?
You can indeed use those things in baking. The thing to note about this is that there are consumer products sold in stores as egg substitutes, and then there's a large industry of selling egg substitutes into industrial food manufacturing operations. And Hampton Creek is not selling egg substitutes currently in supermarkets. They are, however, selling finished packaged products that use their egg substitute. For instance, their Just Mayo mayonnaise. But they're, I think the bigger market for them is selling to industrial food manufacturers where their substitutes compete with a range of other substitutes.
And it sounds like it's taking on a really big industry with deep pockets. I mean, ConAgra, General Mills, Kraft, how are they responding to this startup Hampton Creek?
Well, the food industry is very secretive. I couldn't get anybody at those companies to talk to me in my inquiry. Speaking with food scientists and people who've worked for those companies, I've gathered that industrial food companies do indeed have armies of scientists. Some scientists will sneer at the phrase food scientist and say there's really no science going on there at all. But be that as it may, certainly those companies can bring a great deal of technical prowess to producing whatever food products they want. However, these companies are established. They have existing brands, existing lines of business, and most of their energy, maybe all of their energy, goes into extending those existing brands using existing ingredients. And so the kind of cliche way of summarizing this is to say, they're just putting out a new flavor of Doritos. They don't generally innovate in developing new ingredients, and they certainly don't set out to disrupt their partners, such as the egg industry.
We're talking about the efforts on the part of several startups, specifically Hampton Creek, to create a substitute egg that looks like an egg, acts like an egg if they can get it to, and hopefully costs less than an egg. And Hampton Creek is pulling out some really big names. They've got a, sort of celebrity chef from a Chicago restaurant, a biochemist who worked on developing an AIDS vaccine. How are they actually doing it? What's the composition of this substitute egg?
What Hampton Creek Foods is doing is sorting through all of the cultivated food crops known to mankind and cataloging the proteins that can be extracted from those plants. They won't talk in a lot of detail about how they do it, but I was able to gather that there are sort of two aspects to the process. First is the extraction of the proteins themselves. Egg, as you know, is a bundle of proteins. So they are finding individual proteins that correspond to various functional properties of an egg. A protein that foams like an egg white, a protein that emulsifies, which is to combine water and oil like an egg yolk. And they're extracting them in a way that carefully preserves the unique shape of that protein and thus its ability to function in these egg-like ways. Then they're applying what you'd call bioinformatics, a big data approach to characterizing these proteins so that they can find patterns that will help them predict the protein's functional properties. They want to do this in a comprehensive fashion across all cultivars that are grown industrially, and they want to do it in a very quick fashion, so a high throughput screening method. They evaluate how easily they can be sourced from around the world and an environmental footprint in terms of water and energy requirements. And then it's a matter of actually making it economical.
And it actually looks like an egg.
So not quite. Right now they are working with three products. Two of them don't look like an egg at all. One of them is an emulsifier. The third one is very interesting. It does, in fact, look like an egg. It scrambles up like an egg. And should they finish that product and they say that they're on the cusp, that will appear in grocery stores and it will compete directly with egg beaters. And you pour it into a pan and it gels and coagulates just like an egg, and you end up with a scrambled egg. Right now, I got a chance to taste that product, and I can tell you that it does not taste much like an egg. But there was a very interesting thing that happened during that demo. The chef, Chris Jones, who comes from the Chicago restaurant Moto, sprinkled a little sulfur-laced salt over the Hampton Creek faux scrambled egg. And I can tell you that it tasted much more like an egg after that.
So this idea of sulfuric salt, you know, this liquid that looks like an egg. I'm going to call on my stereotype of the foodie who's trying to make a difference in the industrial food system by eating local, you know, with less impact on the environment, fewer pesticides, non-GMO. Now, how is this population going to take to a phony egg, no matter how ethically sound it is?
I think the simplest answer to that question is that it doesn't matter because that is not Hampton Creek Foods' intended market. Josh Tetrick said to me, if...
Would you just identify Josh Tetrick? Because I don't think you've done that yet.
Sure. CEO of the company, Josh Tetrick, said to me, if we become identified as a vegan product, we're dead. He really needs the mass market in order to make this company what the investors hope it will be. He doesn't want to sell to a foodie who wants to eat local or who cares about, even who cares about animal cruelty or who wants to eat non-GMO. He wants your average consumer who really doesn't care so much what they eat, but wants a satisfying eating experience and wants to pay less money.
Well, Ted Greenwald, a really interesting article. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Ted Greenwald is a freelance writer. You can read his article, The Next Startup Craze, Food 2.0. It's from MIT Technology Review. We've got a link to it at wordofmouthradio.org. So, as we just heard, the properties of eggs are difficult to reproduce in a lab, and they're deceptively difficult to prepare well in the first place. Now on to a chef who reveled in the real thing, from boiled to shirred, Julia Child. Here's just a sliver of Julia talking about the proper way to prepare deviled eggs on the Elegance of the Egg episode of WGBH's The French Chef back in 1963.
Hello, I'm Julia Child, welcome to my kitchen. I'm going to do some deviled eggs today. That's stuffed, hard-boiled eggs. I just love them. Now, if you're going to do a whole lot of deviled eggs, it's a terrible nuisance. If they won't peel, you just make a mess of everything. And here's how to go about that. So I've got 12 eggs here, so I have 3.5 quarts of water. And you want to be sure to have enough water, or it's not going to work. And on goes the heat. And when it comes to the boil, then turn the heat off, cover the pan, and do it for exactly 17 minutes. You want to take them out and put them in ice water, ice cubes and water. You leave them there for 2 minutes. Meanwhile, bring your cooking water back to the boil. And when it's at the boil, take them out 4 at a time, and drop them in the boiling water for exactly 10 seconds. That's 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, and so forth, up to 10. Then out of the boiling water and back into your ice water. They're now ready to peel. Now, to cut these hard-boiled eggs in half lengthwise, dip your knife in water, because that just seems to make it easier to do. And put the yolks into a sieve. I'm going to put in some mayonnaise, and there's a nice little bit of salt, a little bit of pepper, and I'm going to put a little bit of chopped pickle in there, because I happen to be a pickle freak. And then mix that all up. A little bit of sour cream is rather nice in it, too. And now, how to get the egg yolk back into the egg. Well, I think by far the neatest and most professional way to do it is to have one of these pastry bags. And I have a big star tube, and it goes into each one. Do these several hours ahead, but be sure and keep them covered and keep them well chilled. They're wonderful, of course, on a picnic, or you could serve them on a buffet table or as a luncheon dish or for hors d'oeuvres. And people will gobble them up with glee and say you didn't make nearly enough. So come again soon and join me in my kitchen. This is Julia Child. Bon appétit.
the irrepressible Julia Child talking about the proper way to prepare deviled eggs on her program, The French Chef. You can watch a wonderful video of Julia preparing eggs. That's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. We're so grateful for your listening time today. If you do like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us and send us your feedback and share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more of them tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.